I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Fadi Gondor, founder of Aramex, a leading logistics and transportation company based in Dubai in the Middle East. Aramex was founded in 1981 and was the first Arab company to be listed on the NASDAQ in 1997. Welcome, Fadi.
Thank you very much for having me.
Where are you from initially?
I'm Lebanese. I was born in Beirut, but grew up in Jordan. My family is there, my roots are mostly there.
How old were you when you moved to Jordan?
My father moved in the very early 60s, we followed maybe 2-3 times. So I was about 3-4 years old.
What was the impetus for his moving to Jordan?
My father was in the airline business, but he was a political activist, he was involved in a political party then in Lebanon that had tried to take over government. A familiar Middle East story. I'm sorry, there's the cliche there. And then eventually, because he was part of the leadership, he was sentenced to death.
You were so young at the time, but do you remember those days of being transported?
I have a vivid memory of us crossing the border by car and my sister crying. They didn't want us to leave. So we had a scuffle with my mother did with the customs people then, who ended up, because of my sister crying so much, ended up letting us go. So I have this vision in my mind of us struggling at the border.
What did your father do in Jordan?
Well, my father comes from a relatively very poor family. My grandfather was a tram driver for the longest period of time, but he was a visionary in making sure that his 9 kids went to school. And my father was the eldest. So coming from such a background meant that you had to work harder. He left and came and studied here in NYU, by the way. He's an NYU grad from their aeronautics engineering school. He came here specifically to run away from politics. He had never seen an aircraft, and he chose aeronautics because he knew he didn't have to go to college locally because they didn't teach it, because he wanted to get away.
And did he take
as
a ship
a freshman,
here?
He took a ship, took him a month. And he spent 5 years here, worked. His first job was at American Airlines in Chicago. And then family pressure brought him back.
So your father makes his way back to the Middle East. Your father befriended the king and started Royal Jordanian Airlines.
Yeah.
How did he go from being a refugee to having this stature?
At that time, the politics of the region had King Hussein aligned with certain groups, and my father's group seemed to have been aligned with him at that time. Mm-hmm. And thus, when he ended up in Jordan as a political refugee, it was a natural connection. And thus, being an aeronautics engineer, and maybe one of the first 2 or 3 aeronautics engineer in the Arab world then, so what else was he going to do? And he had helped start an airline with a friend of his in Lebanon before that. So aeronautics engineer, entrepreneur, Jordan, small country, needed an airline. There you go.
Now, you were watching this as you were growing up. Did you have any ambitions to follow him in the airline business? Or what were your thoughts as far as a career was concerned?
You know, my memory is vague on this because maybe I didn't have any ambitions as such. I was a hyperactive kid. So my memory of myself was running around all the time, doing naughty and crazy things that scared the heck out of my mom. But I didn't think of what was I going to do in life, really. I didn't think long term. But I watched him. I watched him. I watched his political activism. He still is an incredible role model. The people he connected with were extremely interesting. So we lived a fascinating life, if you want.
And you went back to Lebanon to study at the American school there.
Yes. I'm surprised you got that. But in 1967, as you know, there was the Arab-Israeli war. We used to go to Beirut every summer for vacation out of Jordan. So, and that summer, June of 67, the war broke out. We were in Beirut vacationing. We didn't come back. So I ended up spending 3 years in boarding school in Beirut. I was actually It didn't work out for me in boarding school, so they basically kicked me out, and I went back to the family.
Well, you went to boarding school as a, you were 10 years old.
I was a baby.
Time. Right.
Oh, my God. I still say that to myself. Independent. Believe it or not, I used to get something called gate pass, a gate pass, which means it allows me to go out of school during weekends. And at 10 years old, I would take the bus and go to my grandparents' house, which is about a 45-minute, an hour drive. So I would go to the bus station, change buses. I still remember that and say, I would never let my kids even walk in the street nowadays. Mm-hmm. But I did that. It shaped part of my character.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Fadi Gondor, founder of Aramex, a leading logistics and transportation company based in Dubai in the Middle East. Aramex was founded in 1981 when Fadi was 22 years old, and Aramex was the first Arab company to be listed on the NASDAQ in 1997. You ultimately made your way to the United States, to George Washington University,
yes,
for college. Yes. What were your first impressions of the United States?
Well, I carried a heck of a lot of responsibility then because I came to the U.S. with my mom and my baby sister who had a learning disability. I was the only one driving then, so I had my sister went to a children's hospital, a special education program in D.C. So I had to basically wake up very early in the morning and drive her to school every single day for a full year while being a freshman and part of the swim team at GW. And my impression was the ease at 18 years. It's easy for a teenager to actually make his way around in the U.S. Most of the American students at that time were working to either support themselves or their tuition or their living. In the Middle East, unfortunately, that's unheard of. Our families provide for us until we get married and find a job. So that was fascinating for me. I was embarrassed sometimes to say that I didn't work. It was embarrassing. Your father pays for your tuition? Was like, wow. That was a standard question at that time. And it made me feel uncomfortable eventually, so I stopped talking about it.
You talk about the ease. Are you talking about even in the mundane life, like
ease,
the roads?
Like getting a driver's license. It took me nothing, you know. You did your eye exam and then you sit behind the computer and the driving test was cakewalk, easy.
So it's ironic you say that because we Americans do not think the DMV is easy. We think it's a logistical nightmare.
You guys need to see what happens in the rest of the world and to appreciate of what your DMV is. And then eventually renewal was via mail. That's unheard of anywhere in the world today.
It's the first time we've heard of the DMV being an example of efficiency.
Right. Well, life is, things are relative. So you need to see what happens somewhere else to appreciate what you have.
What about negative impressions of the United States when you were first here?
Negative impressions in my early days was the, and I'm sorry to say that, is the ignorance of world affairs and specifically of the Middle East. It was very frustrating for me, but fantastically, you know, probably if you want to ask me what was the single most important thing that I learned in the U.S. is how to understand the causes that I care for in the Middle East and know how to argue them in the U.S. Mm-hmm. I used to think that it was a natural. We used to think that we have a just cause, and just causes sell themselves. But the reality, nothing sells itself unless you're able to argue it and argue it well and know your facts very well. So from the early days, it was also my first exposure to Jews. It was my first exposure to an argument on the Arab-Israeli conflict. So I basically had to understand democracy, understand argument, understand debate well, and knowing how to present yourself was such an essential. Again, coming from a political family, I automatically became a political activist here with the Arab Students Union. And there was, you know, at that time, it was so heated. And I looked a bit, you know, I had a big beard and my hair was long and I looked like a bit of a revolutionary.
Here you were in a very politicized, heated environment. What about your academic life? What did you focus on?
Oh, you know, I started, my first year was, I went into engineering school. And then I failed miserably. I had an F in a physics class. It didn't work out for me with engineering. I automatically changed into political science. I think it's also a very important step for me because in political science, I also got to understand the habit of reading. Mm. And that helped me a lot in my entrepreneurial life.
So you leave George Washington, you graduate, and you start Aramex out of college by accident. You met your co-founder, Bill Kingston,
yes,
in the United States.
Yes.
How did that happen?
Well, Bill knew my dad. So, and I stumbled into him. I think we were at the Paris Air Show. FedEx was just happening in the U.S. back then. He said, this is an interesting business. Maybe we should do something in the Middle East. Cool. Why not? I am ready. And then he arranged that I go to see the FedEx hub in Memphis. And there was a company called Purelator Courier then in the U.S. Most people don't remember it now, but it used to be bigger than FedEx, believe it or not. Obviously, these were massive for me. FedEx, aircrafts, Middle East does not fit into that. Went back to Amman to start the business.
Here you are doing all this research, going yes. from courier company to courier
right.
company in the United States.
Yes.
But you're a maverick. You seemed a little unreliable and heated.
Why? I still am.
Why would Bill trust you to start this business in
Bill,
the Middle East?
Well, you know, it's not a question of trust. He was basically talking to my father, not to me. A logical man would never get into this business because it's a very, very difficult business to get into because you're effectively having to build a global network from day one. I mean, that's the nature of the beast.
Right. What were the first steps that you took to build Aramex?
Well, the first steps that we took is after I looked at the study that Bill had done, we threw it in the garbage, obviously, because it was done by, an American company who tapped into research and information about the region, which still doesn't exist today. Forget about that. Threw that in the garbage, and we started researching how do you register a company. And at that time, post offices would not allow anybody to get in because they thought we were their competitors, and this was a monopolistic situation for them. The law did not allow for courier companies. But DHL and ourselves were at the forefront of actually fighting for deregulation and allowing people like us to establish the mail delivery business. And then we also stumbled simultaneously onto the fact that a lot of the American companies then, FedEx, UPS, Burlington, Purelator, Airborne Express, gave their packages to deliver in the Middle East. They gave them to competitors like DHL and TNT at that time. So click to us. This is where the niche is. You establish an independent network in the region to deliver packages for these guys who are not interested to be in the Middle East at that time.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Fadi Gondor, founder of Aramex, the leading logistics and transportation company based in Dubai. We'll hear more from Fadi coming up. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Fadi Gondor, founder of Aramex, a leading logistics and transportation company based in Dubai in the Middle East. Aramex was founded in 1981 and was the first Arab company to be listed on the NASDAQ in 1997. So the way you got in the door was by being a supporter of the FedExes in the Middle East. And you weren't their competitor at the time. You were seen as a partner of theirs.
This was our selling point. We said, we're independent. We'll build a network for you. We will customize. Even the word customization was not there yet. But we actually delivered for every single competitor. Aramex was their single source of delivery. They all gave us their packages in the Middle East, so they had one address in the Middle East, even though they hated each other here. We were able to answer a phone for FedEx. We had an Airborne phone, and we had an Emery phone and a Purelator phone, and we delivered on their paperwork. The FedEx brand was there through me. So for them, it was a natural. They didn't have to do anything. We had an office here in New York, and all FedEx needed to do, or Airborne, was to deliver at our JFK office, which still exists today. And from there, we took it all the way. So they didn't have to think of customs, procedures, anything. Just give it to me there, and we'll take it. And eventually, we opened an office in New York, in Paris, London, and in Hong Kong and in Singapore to do exactly the same thing for other courier companies in other parts of the world so that nobody had to think about shipping into the Middle East because it was a bit complicated. Where's the Middle East? We didn't know. The geography was not even known then.
So you were the wholesaler and you were the courier to these couriers.
Absolutely. We were the courier of couriers, if you want, to the Middle East. So we were a known brand to the industry.
Did you know you wanted to branch out on your own after servicing FedEx and these other couriers, learning on their dime?
Yes.
At what point did you say, you know what, I want to eventually compete with these guys?
Yeah, well, I would have loved to stay doing their stuff because it was easy stuff. I didn't have to have retail operations or anything. But the reality of the matter is we knew that they will eventually go global. We started seeing them acquiring companies in Europe. We started seeing them acquiring companies in Asia. So the minute they say they're global, it means the Middle East. So they can do it two ways in the Middle East, either acquire us or go set up their own operation. We've had some discussions with some of them about acquisitions, but we never came to a conclusion, luckily, because the value of the company today and every day that we refused any offer increased.
What was the delta between FedEx and Airborne Express's perception of you as a reliable company in the Middle East to do their work and the reality of what you were? Like, what level of improvisation had to happen?
Oh, plenty of improvisation. So we built the business on the backs of our clients. Meaning, I learned the business from Federal Express and Airborne Express. I mean, I understood my limitations very well, and I understood their power so well. And I took advantage of it to the hilt. Meaning, every time I had the chance to meet, learn, send people from my company to get trained by these guys, we did. And we did that by pushing them very hard to take our kids to get trained by them. And that's how we learned the business. I know everything that I need to know about this industry today because of FedEx and Airborne Express. They taught us the business and they paid us for it. Mm. The other thing that you need to know is their ignorance in the early days of the region, and I can say that now, led me to do things that they didn't know. Meaning, I would have claimed that I had a full network. That was not a lie, but that was not the full truth either. So meaning I always had somebody somewhere to deliver a package for me, but it didn't mean it was my employee. I always found someone, a taxi driver here or a travel agent there, and I would say, you know, call him and say, here's an airway bill coming to you on this airline. Please go to customs and clear it and deliver it. And say you're from Aramex. Mm. Because the reality of the matter is, as all startups are, and especially in the Middle East, we were undercapitalized. We were not sure we were going to make it. And so you needed to improvise. I was regularly taking a flight from Amman, our hub then, to Jeddah in Saudi Arabia and have packages with me.
You were the delivery boy.
I was the delivery boy. I would check into a hotel, literally check into a hotel, wake up very early next morning, grab a cab, tell him I have these 10 addresses. I would go and deliver every package to these people and go back in the afternoon and do my business meetings so that I can try to get my license. So, but nobody knew that then. Mm-hmm. Nobody. I would knock on these doors and say, I have this package. But I was the founder of this company delivering those packages. And that's how I learned the business.
This was in the early 1980s. If I had told you then that you would be a billion-dollar company in 2010, would you have been surprised? Or
I would have been absolutely surprised. Our market cap when we were public on NASDAQ in 1997 never exceeded $70 million. Yeah, small micro cap. $1 billion, my God, you know, at the height of this company, when we went public on the Dubai Stock Exchange, we actually hit $2 billion. And so, wow. I mean, this is incredible for us.
You mentioned FedEx. The founder of FedEx is Fred Smith.
Yes.
Did you meet him?
I met Fred Smith, and I know exactly how I met him. So I went to every single conference on the industry that could happen during those days. I was still in my 20s. So Fred Smith was a keynote speaker at one of those conferences. And I said, I have to meet this man. So right before he finished, I waited at the door. And I'm a shy man in general. And before people attacked, I came to him and said, you know, I am so-and-so, and I have this small company. And then he was nice. He said, yes, nice to meet you. And from then on, I kept following him, believe it or not. Wherever he was a keynote speaker, I would follow Fred Smith, and I would continue to go back and introduce myself and say, remember me? I came to see you once. So, he's without him doing it directly, he was a mentor.
Now, FedEx is one of the world's largest airlines.
Right.
At what point did you start to build an airline business behind Aramex?
We were never an airline. We're still not an airline. We are a non-asset-based company, and we have taken a decision very early on to be a non-asset-based company. One, because we didn't have the capital. Number two, because we knew it can be done without necessarily building an airline or building assets. It is about the customer experience, and that's where we focused.
Do you think if you had more access to capital in the Middle East that you might be a different company? Because if capital had been easier for you, you might have started an airline and been an asset-rich company.
Right, and luckily not. And that's one thing that I would never, if you tell me, what would you do differently? I would tell you I would certainly not look for more capital, because the biggest learning experience for us is having to do things on the very cheap. And that created an incredible amount of innovation and creativity inside the organization. We conserved. We were entrepreneurs on one side, but we understood the value of the dollar. And that is what makes us successful today.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Fadi Gondor, founder of Aramex, a leading logistics and transportation company based in Dubai in the Middle East. Was there ever a turning point in the company? I mean, here you were really just scotch taping things together and improvising your way through building this company. At what point did you say, wow, you know what, we're becoming an institution?
Well, I think by the time Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, in 1990, we had reached a point of having relative stability in the network in the Middle East. Nothing fantastic, nothing fancy, but we had a nice brand with the industry. And then the war comes, and then all hell breaks loose. Kuwait is invaded and occupied. Saudi Arabia airspace was closed. 500,000 American troops on Saudi soil. Airspace in Jordan was closed. We were shut down. And then we had to respond to that crisis internally in the company and manage resources. We had employees in Kuwait then that came driving to Jordan. FedEx withdrew then. They had some offices in the region, by the way, and said, we're shutting down. You deliver everything for us. So we felt a sense of responsibility, and we felt that even with that crisis, we didn't lay off any people then still, if you want, and we were able to scrap and manage and make sure that the company was intact, even though it was an existential issue. But we thought in crisis, when we responded and we responded together, we said, this is a company that is here to stay. As the war ended, clients appreciated this massively. And from there on, we were the company that has stayed. A lot of banks relied on us at that time. Even, you know, I remember the CEO of the Arab Bank, which is one of the largest banks, the largest bank in Jordan, calling me in the middle of the war and telling me, Fadi, we have these magnetic tapes that we need to secure, and I need them out of this country, and I need you to every single day take these magnetic tapes and take them to a country that is more secure. That was a turning point for us, and that was a turning point for our brand in the region. And from there on, we started building the business from the grassroots up.
By the way, you were married to your business. You were growing the company. What was going on in your personal life at the time?
I was married to the business, and I was married to Rula, who is my wife. We're separated now, but she's still my wife and still a very good friend of mine. And the mother of my two sons. It's a strain on family life.
You're on a plane more than 50% of your time. Do you find that enervating or energizing?
I unfortunately am. How shall I put that? I am an addict of traveling now. Which is crazy, because I feel if I spend more than a week in one place, I am stuck. And one thing I didn't want to do, like my father, was to have that constant travel, but I guess that's one habit I inherited from him. And I'm a curious person. I became much more curious as I grow and realize how little I know, and my drive to knowledge is insatiable. So I am constantly traveling. I'm constantly meeting people. I'm constantly doing things. I mean, that's my life today, and I wouldn't have any other way. I love it. I absolutely love it.
You seem to have a lot of energy. You swim every day, or you try to.
Yeah, that's something I will never compromise on. I've been swimming since as long as I remember.
What does it do for you?
It's the ultimate meditation. So people talk about, yoga and breathing exercises. Swimming is the ultimate breathing exercise, because that's all you're doing. And it just clears my mind. It gives me the energy to go on. I'm disciplined in that. I'm disciplined in my food. I'm disciplined in my work. I'm disciplined in my exercise. Even though I am rebellious and here and there, but when it comes to something which I feel is a responsibility towards myself, towards my family, towards what I do, I am extremely disciplined. I have this sense of responsibility which drives me crazy sometimes.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Fadi Gondor, founder of Aramex, a leading logistics and transportation company based in Dubai in the Middle East. In 1997, you decided to go public
Yes.
on an American stock exchange, the NASDAQ. What was the impetus for that?
We ended up wanting to do a private placement in the region to raise money from Arab capital, if you want. But we failed. We failed miserably because we were a non-asset-based company. At that time, people would ask me, do you own buildings? Do you own aircrafts? What do you own? I said, I don't own anything. We own the client experience. I'm in the package delivery business. I do it well. That's all I own. I have a network. I have strategic alliances. No, we don't own anything. We barely own our cars. So for them, why would you want to value? At that time, I think we were valuing the company at around $30 or $35 million in a private placement. So where's the value then? So we failed. So Bill looks at me and says, you know what, Fadi? We're going to go to NASDAQ. And that scared the heck out of me. I said, Bill, what do you mean NASDAQ? NASDAQ, this company is owned by me and you. Nobody looks at our numbers. We barely audit our numbers. We audit them, but we barely audit them. Legally, we're like 500 different companies. There's no one structure. He said, it can be done. That was August 1996. And luckily, Bill, his biggest gift to us, he also convinced Airborne Express around the same time to give us $2 million for 9% of the company. For the first time, after talking to Airborne for 13 years, they said, okay, here's $2 million. So the biggest check I had ever seen in my life kept me sleeping for quite some time, because I had, life for an entrepreneur was managing cash flow. Other than making sure packages get delivered, I needed to every morning spend 2 hours with my chief financial officer juggling our payments, because we had such a terrible reputation for being such late payers. But that's life when you're scrapping to run a business. In any case, so Airborne buys 9% for $2 million, and then we say NASDAQ. All by January of 1997, we were on the exchange. So that was miraculous. I can't tell you. And I did the roadshow with Bill. We were only raising $7 million, believe it or not. This was a micro. 2 million of those went to the lawyers and to the banks. We were left with $5 million. And that was the first check that I ever took myself personally as an owner from the Green Shoe. Mm-hmm. So there was, an oversubscription, and we ended up making, $300,000-$400,000 extra. If you tell me what was the turning point, yes, originally what happened in the Iraq War, Iraq-Kuwait War, the reality of the matter, the biggest turning point in our life was us going on NASDAQ, because that made us a legitimate global brand in the eyes of our clients in the Middle East. Nobody had ever done it before. And the respect we got from banks, from clients, from people walking down the street who had heard about the story, until today, we're still called as Aramex, the company that was the first to go public on NASDAQ. It is a stamp on our forehead, and we're proud of it. It's a fascinating story.
It's a fascinating story, especially because you have achieved such success in such an unlikely region. What needs to change?
I'll tell you what needs to change. It needs to have a government system that has a loose safety net. In the Gulf, where there's oil money, there's a huge safety net. The citizen does not feel the urge to innovate or to create or to create his own business, because our education system starts from day one telling us that the government is going to take care of us. We are not taught the skills that entrepreneurs need to be taught. We are not told that private enterprise is legitimate. Even though the Prophet Muhammad was an entrepreneur, and he was a traveler in trade, which means he had to deal with people, and the owner of the business was a woman, his eventual future wife. We don't teach our kids, because the state is predominant in our life. So we need to change our education system. We need to legitimize and say that entrepreneurship, private enterprise, not working for government is okay, is actually good for you. Having venture capital, angel investors bet on ideas and not bet on hard assets. We love building buildings, but I don't see as many people believing in ideas and believing in entrepreneurs and thus believing in people. But it is not as arid as people think it is. The Arab world is changing very quickly. There is a huge reservoir of entrepreneurs. I'm an angel investor, as you know. I can't tell you the amount of people that come to me on a daily basis asking, showing me their business plans and asking me for either help or advice or capital.
Thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
My guest has been Fadi Gondor, founder of Aramex, the leading logistics and transportation company based in Dubai in the Middle East. Coming up, we'll hear from Fred Swanaker, founder of African Leadership Academy, a school focused on training Africa's future leaders. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Fred Swanaker, founder of African Leadership Academy, an institution that's dedicated to developing Africa's next generation of leaders. The school admits students from across Africa and is committed to encouraging graduates to stay in Africa. Fred founded African Leadership Academy in 2004 when he was 27 years old. He's a graduate of McAllister College in Minnesota and has an MBA from Stanford Business School. Welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
You lived in over four countries before you were 18 years old. Why did your family keep moving?
You see, Ghana had an excess supply of skilled labor. And so other countries in Africa, as they were developing, would come to Ghana to look for professionals like lawyers and teachers and doctors. And my dad was a magistrate and my mother was a teacher. So they were recruited by different countries in Africa to come and work in their civil service. So that's how we moved around.
You did your primary and secondary schooling in Africa, and then you went to McAllister College in Minnesota. What was the thinking behind that?
My mother had been to graduate school in Minnesota. And so when I was growing up, I used to look at pictures in her album, and I would see pictures of her, you know, in the snow. McAllister is also known in Ghana and Africa because that's where Kofi Annan, the former Secretary General of the United Nations, went to college.
Did you have the intention of definitely returning, or was there part of you that thought, oh, you know what, maybe I'll stay put in the United States?
No, you see, one thing that all these experiences of living and working in different parts of Africa did is it made me very passionate about being an African. Mm-hmm. So most people who grew up in Africa only know the country that they were born in. In fact, their perceptions of the rest of the continent is what they see on CNN. I had seen that there was tremendous beauty in Africa and tremendous potential, that we were really the next frontier of development.
What did you think were the key ingredients to helping with Africa's development?
When I look at the history of Africa, we've been through different phases of development. You had the period in the 60s, which was the independence era. You know, African countries breaking away from the shackles of colonialism and gaining their political independence. And then you moved into phase two, which was the period of real political instability. Then phase three, which is more stability. And there's more semblance of democracy. And when, you know, a change of government happens by force, it's seen as an exception now rather than the rule it was 20 years ago. The thing that's left to be done in Africa now, I believe, and this was my perception when I was graduating from McAllister College, was to create prosperity and to eradicate poverty. So the first job I got out of college was with McKinsey, mm-hmm. the consulting firm. Mm-hmm. I wanted to understand business. I wanted to see how business was being done in Africa. And that was how I began my journey of understanding, what we needed to do to bring this next phase of change to Africa.
There have only been like a handful of leaders that have helped to transform African society, ranging from, you know, Nelson Mandela to Desmond Tutu. Why do you think Africa has kind of such a scarcity of leadership?
See, when Ghana got independence in 1957, there was something like 18,000 university graduates in the whole of sub-Saharan Africa, if you exclude South Africa from the picture. Countries like the DRC, the Democratic Republic of Congo, had 4 university graduates in 1957. So imagine the independence era arriving in Africa in the late 50s and early 60s. When Kenneth Kaunda was forming his cabinet in Zambia, you know, he had 4 university graduates to work with. And so that's the state at which Africans found themselves in the first set of leaders who took over the continent.
Your mother started a school in Botswana, and you, at age 18, became the headmaster of that school. Why did you become the headmaster of the school?
My mother was a really great teacher. And so the parents approached her and said, you know, would she set up a school for them? But she had no experience raising money. My dad had just passed away.
He died of high blood pressure and hypertension. Basically had a heart attack, yeah.
So she didn't have any financial resource of her own, and she had to look after 4 kids. So she said, look, I can't quit my job as a teacher and start the school for you. What I will do is I'll start a study group. And then it grew, more and more kids came, and then the next thing was 20 kids and then 25 kids. And then I had finished high school, and I had a year to wait before I went to college. And so my mother said, you know, why don't you run the school for me? And so for a year, I was the headmaster. I taught some classes. I managed some of the teachers and dealt with the parents. And in the afternoons, I'd go and meet with her and we'd discuss the strategy for the next day. And today, that school is one of the top-performing primary schools in Botswana.
And it's called Mount Pleasant English Medium School.
Exactly. And it has about 300 children.
Did you think, you know, during that year that, you know what, I'd like to make a career out of being the headmaster of a school?
Absolutely not. I had no idea that one day I'd be back in education and in leadership development. You know, I saw my future as a businessman.
So here you were. You were at McKinsey, and then you decided to go to Stanford Business School. And McKinsey paid for your education at Stanford Business School, about $125,000. And you were supposed to return to McKinsey, but instead you decided to start African Leadership Academy. What was the catalyst for saying, you know what, there is a scarcity of leaders in Africa, I'm going to start ALA rather than return to McKinsey?
So in between my first and second year at Stanford, as most MBA students do, I had to find an internship. Given that I was supposed to go back to McKinsey after my MBA was finished, I thought, let me just do something interesting. So there was an opportunity to go and work in Nigeria to help set up a microfinance institution. Mm-hmm. And I went to Nigeria, and in the course of that, I met these wealthy families who were complaining to me about the fees they were paying to send their, you know, children to expensive boarding schools in the UK. They were paying about $50,000 a year to send them there. So I was thinking, wow, why are we paying so much money to send young people to these schools in the UK? Why don't we have the best education institutions in Africa that can keep them on the continent? Because I was worried that these young people that were leaving were the future leaders of Africa. So that's when the light bulb went off and I said, you know, why don't I actually build this institution? And so I said, you know what, I need to find a way to pay this $120,000 off to McKinsey and really do this. I didn't know where I was going to get the $120,000 from, but when I graduated, I called McKinsey and said, you know, I'm not coming back.
How did you raise the $120,000 to pay them back?
I had borrowed some money from my mom. And then also I had raised some money to start ALA from my friends and family, and part of that was the salary I was going to pay myself. And so what I did is I took the salary that I was going to pay myself and gave it to McKinsey.
Mm-hmm.
So then I had no salary to live on for the next 2 years.
And where were you living at the time?
In Johannesburg.
So what was it like having no salary? What did that mean daily?
It meant daily I didn't know where my meals were going to come from, where I would get money to buy clothes from, and, you know, other basic things that people who have a salary take for granted. So I had to become creative in terms of the way I lived. My friends would buy me lunch, you know, so I made sure that I always had a lunch appointment with a friend.
Uh-huh. Where did you live?
I slept on people's couches and, you know, friends' cottages in the backyards, mm-hmm. and those kinds of things.
Your mother, as we discussed, was an educator. What was her perspective?
She thought I was crazy, even though she had done it herself. She hadn't done it, I guess, in such a risky manner.
Her name's Edna, and she eventually gave you $100,000, which, by the way, have you given back to her, or was it more of a gift?
Well, it's something I was meant to pay back, but I think over time she's forgiven the loan.
Ah, it's a forgivable loan.
Exactly.
I see. So here you are sleeping on friends' couches and having people buy you lunch. Was there one or two people in the early days that really helped to, you know, get the academy off the ground or to make the idea of the academy more of a reality?
Yeah, it's definitely. I mean, they were my partners, my co-founders. You know, one was a man called Chris Bradford, who I had met when I was at business school, and then my two former bosses from McKinsey. Mm-hmm. We initially raised about $200,000.
And then you were looking to raise $7 million, and the bulk of that came from a woman named Rebecca Capizio. Why was Rebecca interested in African Leadership Academy?
We set out on a search for a possible campus. And we went to this area just outside of Johannesburg called the Cradle of Humankind, which is where some of the oldest human remains have been found. It's a very beautiful setting. And there was a conference center there that we approached and said, you know, can we rent this conference center and use it for our academy? And they said, you know, sorry, we're fully utilized, but why don't you go next door? There's a property there. There was a manager at the farmhouse, and we kind of shared what we were trying to do. And he said, you know, we don't have a space there that's big enough for you to use for your campus, but the owner of this property is very interested in education. So why don't you send us something and we'll send it to the manager, to the owner. And we didn't know that the owner was this woman, Rebecca Capizio, who comes from the Oppenheimer family that owns De Beers in South Africa.
De Beers, the Diamond Empire.
The Diamond Empire, exactly. So we sent her a one-page description of what we were trying to do, and she wrote back and said, you know what, I don't have a facility that you can use, but I like this idea so much that I'm willing to build it for you.
Huh.
And we thought, wow, does she really know who we are? I mean, just from a paragraph, she's willing to commit. Does she know how much money we'd need? So then we said, you know, okay, we're coming to Seattle in a few weeks. Can we come and meet with you?
Because she was living in Seattle at the time.
Exactly. That's why she wasn't at her property when we visited. Mm-hmm. And so we went and met with her, and you know, we said, look, this is going to cost us about $5 million to build it. Are you willing to commit this money? And she said, yeah. And that changed everything.
Do you remember that specific moment? Were you in her house when she talked to you about it?
We're sitting in a lobby in a hotel in Seattle, and she had come with her husband, and I was there with Chris. When we met her, it was kind of a surreal experience. You know, we were these 27-year-old guys. With just an idea on a piece of paper.
Incidentally, in addition to Rebecca Capizio, another woman was pretty instrumental to you in the early days, and that was the former CEO of Hewlett-Packard, Carly Fiorina, mm-hmm. who had gone to high school randomly in Ghana. Mm-hmm. How did she help you?
At this time, I didn't know how to raise money. I had been to visit the dean at the Stanford Business School to ask him for advice on how to raise money. And one of his pieces of advice to me was that you should never ask for money in a first meeting with someone. So this is our first meeting with Carly Fiorina. And, you know, we had lunch with her. And then at the end, she said, okay, so why did you want to meet with me today?
Mm. And meanwhile, you have his advice in your ear.
I had his advice in my ear. I said, don't ask her for money. So I said, well, you know, perhaps you could help us with your relationships in the technology world to help us get some
computers for our school. And he said, okay, fine, I'm happy to do that. And then she said, and I said, well, you know, maybe you could also help us build relationships with the South African government. And she said, yeah, sure, I'm happy to do that. And then she said, is there anything else? And so at this point, I'm sitting there thinking, okay, she, you know, she's asking us if we need money. But the dean of Stanford said, don't ask for money on your first meeting. So Chris is kicking me under the table saying, you know. So then eventually I was like, well, we're also looking to raise money and, you know, perhaps you could contribute. 3 months later, she gave us $100,000.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Fred Swanaker, founder of African Leadership Academy, a school focused on training Africa's future leaders. How did you encourage applicants? How did you encourage people to come?
We had, you know, surveyed parents. We had talked to headmasters of other schools in Africa, had asked them about the concept that we were proposing, and, you know, the feedback was generally quite positive. But we had never actually spoken to young people. And if you think about it, they were the client base, the customers, in a way. So 2007, we said, oh, actually, no, we're opening our doors a year from now. We need to start recruiting our first class. So we hired a team of people, and we went around and started visiting schools. And we did a mailing to about 2,000 schools. And we were shocked when the deadline arrived and we had received 1,700 applications from 35 countries for our first class. And there were only 100 places available.
Who were some students who really impressed you? You're like, wow, I want this student in my school.
One of the things we asked in the application form, we said, tell us about a time you identified a need in your community, mm-hmm. and what did you do about it? And so Belinda's application, she talked about how she was she lived in a suburb of Harare in Zimbabwe. And every day she used to see these three kids coming around and begging for food. And so she approached them and to find out why they were begging, and it turned out that their parents had died from AIDS. And so she decided that she wanted to do something about this to help them so they could stop begging. And she had been learning agriculture at school and was learning how to raise chickens. So she asked her mom for, you know, about a couple of dollars and used that to buy a couple of chickens that could lay eggs. And she built this chicken business. And with that, she was able to generate enough income that she was able to feed this family of three, these three kids. And then she taught the kids how to look after the chickens and also how to grow a vegetable farm and so on. And soon they were able to look after themselves completely independently, and they were able to have enough funding that the oldest child could now go to school. And she did all this by herself when she was 16, 17.
You created from the start a financial incentive for your graduates to stay put in Africa. How does that work?
The vast majority of the young people that we admit to the academy cannot afford to pay the fees. So we give them scholarships. It costs about $25,000 per child for 1 year. We don't give them that scholarship as a grant, but as a forgivable loan. And so when they graduate from the two-year program and go into college, that loan continues accruing interest. So all we ask is that they return to Africa by the age of 25 and stay and serve the continent for 10 years. They can do whatever they want to do in Africa. And if they don't return, or they leave at some point before they're 10 years old, then they have to repay that loan with interest. Mm-hmm. There's a model like this in Singapore and in Thailand. There's a school called Raffles Junior College, and they have a 97% return rate.
African Leadership Academy aims to develop the next generation of leaders. What does that mean practically or daily?
A big part of this development is what we call giving them practice in leadership. So while they're at the academy, they all have to do what's called a culminating project, where they either have to launch a business or launch a social venture in the community. And what we're trying to do there is to simulate the kind of experience that Mark Zuckerberg had in his dorm room at Harvard when he started Facebook. So over the last few years, we've launched about 42 different ventures, ranging from a bank that operates on our campus to a farm on the campus to a clothing store to sustainable community agricultural projects that have all been spearheaded by these young people. And we have a venture fund on our campus that invests in them. And aim there is to really give them the taste of being an entrepreneur and being a leader in real time and real life. And we believe that if you give them this defining experience at that age, it gives them the foundation and the passion to go on and do entrepreneurial ventures and to be leaders on a much bigger scale later on in their lives. If I hadn't had this experience when I was 18, running my mother's school, I don't think I would have had the confidence or the experience to one day do what I'm doing today with ALA, which is on a much bigger scale. And if you look back, a lot of entrepreneurs, Richard Branson, when he was 15, 16, was selling magazines. And that prepared him to go and launch Virgin one day. And so it's the same kind of practice and leadership that we like, that we spend a lot of time trying to give these young leaders. And then the other thing we're doing is exposing them to a network of mentors and potential advisors and people who can open doors for them as they go through different stages of their lives.
So what's an example?
There's a young man from the Democratic Republic of Congo. He's a refugee. He came to ALA on a scholarship, and while he was there, we had a guest speaker who visited campus. And this woman is involved in using theater as a way to help victims of trauma. Joseph was so struck by her talk that he said, you know, I really want to go and replicate this in my refugee camp. And in the process, the woman also got so involved that she helped him raise $20,000, and he used that to build the first high school in his refugee camp. And that's all happened because of that network that was struck, that conversation that happened when this woman visited campus to be a speaker.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
My guest has been Fred Swanaker, founder of African Leadership Academy.
If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at FromScratchRadio.com or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. Our website is FromScratchRadio.org. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.